Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome your Studcast host of television and radio fame, Tony Basilio.
And we welcome you to another edition of the Tennessee Studcast. It is episode 23. Can you believe that? Time flies when you're having fun. Right around this Christmas season, the Stud has given all of us, a special gift here, because we today are going to go back to 1965. And we're going to go back to the Supercard. A Supercard that not only lit the Southeast on fire, but lit the wrestling world on fire. A Supercard that included the likes of Joe Scarpa and a young Bob Armstrong. Argentina Rocca, the Von Brauners, Al Galento, the Stud's own father, and Rocky Marciano, whose name came up in our last Studcast. And when last we left you, the Tennessee Stud was telling you how this card came together through the brilliant wrestling mind of his father and those that he had helping him on the ground there in the Southeast Territory where these folks had encamped. And they decided to put this card on in July of 1965 in Ponce de Leon Park. So much history, so much to unpack in today's Studcast. Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I don't know, man. I don't know what you do. So many people had popped for what you did last week. I don't know how you top it, man.
I'm on the top it. We just got the build up last week. We're going to get the blow off this week. You know, that's what I like. We see things developing, you know, and that's what you do as a wrestling promoter is you try to set the stage. You've got to develop talent. You have to get people over. And then you have to figure out how the heck do we do something that's going to just set it on fire, just going to make the people go crazy for an event. And that's exactly where we've built up to for this Studcast, number 23. And like you say, Tony, it's unbelievable. 23 episodes, and it's remarkable the comments and how involved people are becoming in my family's life story. I never thought it would reach this point. And just am so blessed by the good Lord to have lived the life I lived, and for my dad to have lived that life, and for my grandfather to have lived that life, for my brother and my cousins and the Fields brothers and all of my family. And it's just a pleasure to be able to have the opportunity to talk to people about it, to sit and tell the stories about it. And today is one of the primo days for me. My horse is just out there. He's on his hind legs right now, just ready to roll. He's ready to go. And so I'm hoping fans will get themselves saddled up here, and we're going to have about an hour to spend on talking about the biggest wrestling crowd in Georgia wrestling history, period, any time frame. Anywhere, anytime, the largest. There will never be another one like it. I don't believe they will ever do it again.
Especially to capacity, Stud. I mean, that's the one thing that needs to be pointed out. You're talking about a 20,000-seat capacity park that went 180% to capacity. That's how that number needs to be put when you finally tell us what the crowd is. That's how that number finally needs to be put in perspective. You're talking about people on top of people on top of people. You're talking about a fire marshal's nightmare, a violation of fire marshal codes, And your pop was great. I mean, the way he worked with the elected officials, the way he worked with the municipalities. I mean, he was a smart businessman. He knew what he was doing.
Well, we're going to add to all this, Tony, which is another remarkable part of this. We're going to have, when this bells rings for this event, there are going to be 10,000 people or more on the streets that can't get in, that want to get in. That crowd could have been 10,000 more than what it was. And it created such a turmoil in downtown Atlanta that they had police everywhere. They could not disperse the crowd. People would not leave. And they could hear the crowd roaring on the street outside the park, and that just, they were just begging to get in, or just to let me stand here and hear them roar in there. So it's an unforgettable night for Georgia wrestling, and I'm honored to be able to tell the story of it and to try to paint the picture for everyone as to how it all worked. Let's start, Tony, with Ponce de Leon Park. We've had brief discussions of Ponce de Leon Park in the past. I think we had a question one time about it, and as you just said, I looked some of the information up. It was built in 1923. It was built for a minor league baseball team in Atlanta. In 1923, the year it was built, it burned. It caught fire and burned. And in 1924, it was built originally to hold 6,800 people. I guess they were lucky that it burned because it wouldn't hold the capacity that was necessary. There was a lot of interest in minor league baseball. So when it burned, they rebuilt it at 20,000 seats. Now, they tripled the size of the facility, which now it makes it the best place in Atlanta to have this event. In 1965, there is no Atlanta Stadium where the Braves are going to end up playing. There is no football field. There are a football field at Georgia Tech. There's that type of facility. But this is like a public park where people are used to going. And my dad decides, let's do this event in the baseball stadium. Now, he had done these. He'd done one in a football stadium in 1958 in Mobile, Alabama. He had done one in a baseball stadium, Rushwood Park in Memphis, set an all-time record for that city, biggest crowd ever drawn in the state of Tennessee, still today. Nobody ever has beaten it. He did it in a baseball stadium in Phoenix, biggest crowd ever drawn in Arizona. And now he's about to do it in Ponce de Leon Park in Atlanta. It will be the biggest crowd in Georgia history. You did some studying. I think you've got something on another match that took place there, Tony. And let's start with that. I think fans will be amazed at this. This really got me.
Well, the thing that's really interesting is you talk about how that park had a capacity when it was first built in 1923, and then the fire destroyed it. You got a 25,000-seat capacity, but it was very famous in 1945 for hosting Dempsey and Cowboy Luttrell in 1945. And so we're talking about roughly 20 years later, Stud, roughly 20 years later in that stadium that was rebuilt, where the Atlanta Black Crackers had played of the old Negro Baseball League. We're talking about a very hallowed place when you talk about Ponce de Leon Park in Atlanta, Georgia. And let's point this out when you talk about the size of the crowd. Atlanta, Georgia at that point in time, Stud, is a sleepy southern town. It is not the tremendous metropolis that it has grown to. You don't have millions on top of millions of people stuck on interstates every day and all the traffic that's come to be known for. At that point in time, you're talking about a sleepy southern town. And the type of crowd, the size of the crowd that we're going to discuss today is a tremendous coup at that point in time.
And you're exactly right. I remember in 1965 that you could drive from the airport on 75, now that 285 runs around there. Back in those days, there was no 285. It was prior to 285. You had 75 that runs through downtown Atlanta. You had 85 that goes through downtown Atlanta that runs on into Alabama. You have Interstate 20 that runs through Atlanta. It is in a crucial part of America. It is going to become one of the biggest cities in the South, but it wasn't there. You're exactly right. It was a sleepy little country town. You could leave 275 on Interstate 75 and go out where 285 goes through Marietta. In that area, you could run through downtown Atlanta in 15 minutes. And now you're lucky to make that run. If you're running at 5 o'clock, you're lucky to make it in 2 hours. Every freeway is congested now. Thousands and millions of people live in Atlanta. And it is going to become a monster city. We're lucky, or Dad's lucky, or I'm lucky as a young man to be a part of all this and to see all this take place. Atlanta's going to become the Hoss in the South. It will be, everything will run through Atlanta. It will experience tremendous and phenomenal growth. It's events like this one that we're about to discuss today that are going to put Atlanta on the map. People are going to talk about Atlanta everywhere. Let me back up real quick. That event you talked about with Dempsey and Clarence. I never realized Cowboy Luttrell's first name was Clarence. Clarence Cowboy Luttrell. You and I have briefly discussed this off air, not during part of the program, but how many times a boxer has had an exhibition. They call them exhibition. They're not actual matches. They're usually, terminology is, this is an exhibition event. These exhibition events in which a boxer wrestles against a wrestler. The boxer puts the gloves on, the wrestler is able to wrestle and do whatever he does as a wrestler, and the two compete against one another. I have never seen one of those events in my lifetime, but there have been several of those that have taken place. I know Ali and Inoki in Japan, and I don't have the years that that event took place. But you had then one of the greatest world boxing champions of all time, Muhammad Ali. I think he's probably past his prime when this event takes place. And you have Antonio Inoki, who becomes the kingpin of New Japan Wrestling, which is still around today and a great organization still, New Japan. So you've got two great athletes right there that are going to go against each other, each doing their own thing, and to find out who is the better man. I don't even know the results of the Inoki match, and I believe, now this off the top of my head, I don't think there was a winner. I think there was 15 rounds, whatever the rounds, however that worked out. So I know that there are that, and I know you have this one.
That was in June of 1976, so roughly 11 years after the one we're going to discuss today. Ali fought Inoki. Wrestler versus boxer match took place at Budokan Hall in Tokyo, Japan. Inoki, of course, top wrestling star in Japan at the time, trying to prove that wrestling was, in fact, on par with any form of martial arts. And Muhammad Ali was the heavyweight champion of the world, as a year earlier he beat none other than Smokin' Joe Frazier to regain his title. That show was seen, Stud, check this out, 150 closed-circuit television locations throughout the U.S. It was also a final match shown on wrestling cards throughout the country. So they had various local live cards at various municipalities, and then they would show that one finally, the way they staged that one. Andre the Giant battled Chuck Webner in Shea Stadium as well. So there's another example of that. I'll give you another example of that, which we wouldn't discuss, but how about from the movie Rocky, where you had in Rocky III, you had Hulk Hogan get in the ring with none other than Sylvester Stallone, and that really helped set the scene for what became modern professional wrestling. So it's interesting the way that deal worked. But back to that Ali situation with Inoki. Inoki laid on his back and wore Ali's lower extremities out for 15 rounds. Ali threw less than a dozen punches because he couldn't get down on the ground with him. He had boxing gloves on. The fans booed. It was a horrible-looking fight. It was a horrible fight, though it took in millions and millions of dollars. Ali made over $6 million that night. Inoki made somewhere between $2 and $4 million. And that ain't bad business. That ain't bad business, Ron Fuller.
No, at Budokan. I wrestled in Budokan in 1983. Budokan is a sumo. It's made for sumo wrestling. And in Japan, it's a strange place. There are no seats. You don't sit on a ringside seat. There are no seats in that building. And I wrestled in there, sold out in 1983. I think I was told there's 20. I said, what does this hold? Because when you go out and look in an arena, when people aren't sitting in chairs, it's a totally different perspective. They sit with their legs crossed, side by side, squeeze their bodies in there. I asked the JoJo, it used to be an interpreter there that took you everywhere, and he did all your talking and everything because you couldn't speak to people. And I said, JoJo, what does this hold? And he says, about 24,000. You know, it was full. I mean, to the very top. You know, I was like, wow, this is a huge crowd, big crowd. So Budokan, that's where this match took place, Budokan, is still there. It was in 83. I don't know if it's still there today. But it's a real quick story about Budokan is I wrestled early that night, and they had these, I thought they were bathtubs, huge bathtubs in the back. And you went in, so I went and wrestled, and I came back, and I took off my clothes, and I got into one of these bathtubs. There were a series of maybe six or eight side by side. They were maybe 12 feet wide and 15 feet long, you know, probably waist deep. So I got in one, JoJo wasn't there, and I finished my match, and I figured, well, there's no showers, so this must be the bath. So I get in the bath, and all the Japanese, there's a couple of guys that are back there in the dressing room area, and they come screaming. They're like, they're doing all the thing, and they're like, I can see they're upset, you know. I was like, and I can't talk to them. I said, hey, what's the deal, man? You know, and they're going, Tanamana. They're giving me these hand signals like, get out, get out. So I get out of the bathtub, and along comes JoJo. And I say, JoJo, what's the story here, man? Is this a bathtub? And he goes, oh, no, Ron. He goes, didn't know bathtub. This where sumos come here, and they, where they take their bath. And I said, yeah, well, I'm in there. He said, no, you don't get in the tub. It's sacred water. And I said, what do you mean it's sacred water? It don't look sacred to me, man. I said, it's just a bathtub, isn't it? And he goes, no. He goes, I said, well, how do they take a bath if they don't get in the water, man? And he says, see, there was a big, like, pots, and they had handles on them sitting by the water. And he dipped down in the water, and he says, Ron, you take this, squat down, a pour on your head. You know, I said, are you serious? I said, I can't get in that bathtub and take the bath. No, it's sacred. He goes, sumo, sacred. You know, take pan, dip in water, and squat down, and pour water on your head. I'm like, oh, my God, I've seen it all now, right? So, I mean, it's different things in different places. At Budokan, I can't believe it's at Budokan, because that was my last match in Japan, to finish the tour at Budokan. It's amazing to me, Tony. When I think about it, I hear these stories that I was a part of so many things and got to go and see those places and actually wrestle in those buildings and find out that sumos are sacred. I never realized those big fat boys were sacred. You know, I don't know how the heck they become sacred. But it's amazing what this world has out there and how different we all are.
I never realized how many boxers versus wrestler matches there were. And give you a couple of more, Stud, if you've got a second. You mind if I rattle a couple off?
No, go ahead.
Scott Ledoux, Larry Zbysko in 1986 as part of AWA's Wrestle Rock Supercard. Mark Gastineau versus Derek Dukes, which took place in 1991, the last vestiges of the AWA. Butterbean versus Mark Marrow, 1997, pay-per-view In Your House. Pay-per-view, Butterbean versus Bark Gunn in 99, Evander Holyfield and Matt Hardy in 2007 as part of a Saturday night's main event. Floyd Mayweather versus The Big Show is another event that took place. Ricky Hatton versus Chavo Guerrero back on November 9 of 2009. Mike Tyson and Chris Jericho in a tag team versus D-Generation X. And then recently, one that came to mind, and this is kind of more along the shoot lines, but still, in keeping with the supercard theme, was what we saw recently, the Mayweather-Conor McGregor deal, which had, I mean, let's face it, it wasn't worked, but it had wrestling elements in the way that the thing was promoted, which helped blow it up into a worldwide phenomenon. They took a lot of the template that your father would have used in 1965, and a lot of those elements to help blow that thing up into a national sensation. And if your father was here, he would have been very proud of Mayweather and Conor McGregor, the way they played that thing publicly to the press, both becoming multi-multi-multi-rich-for-life millionaires in the process.
Yeah, truly amazing. Truly amazing. And, you know, when you describe the Inoki match, I never saw that match with Ali and Inoki, but it makes sense. Inoki is a wrestler, and he's not going to stand up and try to do anything, give Ali a chance to hit him with a shot, you know, and end it quick. By staying low and staying on that mat, he forced Ali to wrestle his style. And like you said, Ali only threw 12 punches or whatever it was. That was how I would have done it if I'd had a shoot with a boxer. I would have not stood up toe-to-toe with him and try to lock up with him. He's not going to lock up with you. He's going to knock you out. So, you know, makes a lot of sense. This is a great start to our program today. We've gotten off to talk about something different than where we were. But at the same time, I think these things are so interesting. It's amazing to me how many times they've had those type of events, and the importance and the names of some of those individuals is truly amazing. Let's go back to the night in July of 65 that they're going to have this event. I'm in the 11th grade. I'm selling tickets at that event. So I get to see what happens outside the arena before I go inside the arena. So I go into the ticket booth at about 5:30 in the afternoon, because you have to bear in mind that there is no Ticketmaster in 1965. There are no advance sales. So there was probably 40 ticket sellers for that event. We actually met on the baseball field at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and we were assigned, you're going to sell general admission, here is your booth, and you're going to sell such and such. I was selling ringside tickets that night. They had 40 different, some of the booth that I was in was probably 15 by 15. It had wood structure at the bottom of it, about up to about 3 feet high was wood. And above that wood, it had bars that went up another 8 feet high, and so that people could talk to you through the bars, but they couldn't get their hands in there to get money or anything like that. I didn't know that at that point before we started selling how important those bars were going to be that night, but it ended up being extremely important. So I go out and take a spot in the booth about 5:30, 3 hours prior to the event. By that time, there's probably, I'm going to guess, 5,000 people waiting on the sidewalks. And just to describe kind of this, where the park was and how things were situated, there's a six-lane street in front. The buses, they come up and drop people off right in front of the park. Now, the park's a big structure, so there could be 10 buses back up one behind another, 10 in a row, that are releasing people. Now, you've got a parking area across the street. You have Sears and Roebuck's national headquarters, monstrous building, lots of parking there. You have parking on the backside of this park. You have parking on both sides of the park. The park has a capacity of 20,000 people that sit in the stands. Beyond that, there are 3,000 ringside seats around the ring. The ring is placed out between the pitching mound and home plate. And the ringsiders, if you sit in those sections between the ring and the actual grandstand, those ringsiders, the rows of ringside went all the way back to the grandstand. So you had probably, I would guess, 20 rows of ringside on four sides of that ring. The ones that were out into the field, people sat on the grass, obviously. If you were on a baseline, you're sitting in dirt. So it's a tremendous project just to set up for something like this. You have 3,000 seats out there on the field, pretty close to home plate, so that everybody has a pretty decent view. The plan was, because they didn't know what to expect, there is no advance sale. So you've got to sell to every individual that comes through that turnstiles at that event. So you've got 40 ticket sellers. You have 3,000 ringside seats on the field, and they're talking about what happens if we fill the stands, if the grandstands get full. And there was talk then about they would sell, general admission would continue to sell, and they would allow people to stand on the field itself behind the ringsiders. There was no discussion about the capacity. I don't think, as you were saying, that there was a fire marshal present at that meeting that took place in the afternoon prior to sending the ticket sellers to the booths. I don't remember a fire marshal being there. And I really don't believe, Tony, that they thought that it would be necessary. I think they thought, well, they'll be lucky if they sell the park out and they can sell out their ringside. So I go to the ticket booth. It's 5 o'clock and there's probably 5,000 people there. The 3,000 ringside tickets sell out in less than an hour and a half. In less than 90 minutes, 3,000 ringside tickets have been purchased. I don't remember the prices. I wish I did. There is a poster I think I'm going to try to put on the website, TN Stud, for this particular event that will show. It may show the prices. I'm pretty sure it does. But it actually has some of the card there. They couldn't put the entire card on the one poster. So it's the type of poster that at my age in that summertime, I would go every week and put out those posters during the day. I would do 2 days in the city of Atlanta, driving around and actually putting posters in the windows. It was a great advertisement that the old man came up with. My dad came up with the idea, and you would give out these tickets that were there. You got a little cut in the rate. It's called cut rate tickets. If the price for a general admission seat was $3, you could get in for $2 if you had one of these tickets. We used to give those away for some events. This event, there was none of those given away. So there's this huge crowd. They start buying tickets at 5 o'clock. From 5 o'clock until 8:30, because my ticket booth sat very close to the street, there was a crowd, a mob of people between my ticket booth and where the buses came to start letting people off. And it never ceased to be a mob there in that area. The police started showing up about 7 o'clock. Because there was, I guess, calls were going out that Ponce de Leon was blocking up. That six-lane road was getting so blocked that people, once they filled out that distance between my ticket booth and the sidewalk itself, the street, they started standing out in the street. When that happened, it kept the buses from being able to pull up to the front to let people out. Now you've got a problem developing. So the police start arriving. And it starts out, you see a couple of cars, and they got the blue lights on. By 8:30, it's a riot out there. It's like unbelievable. There's 100 police cars, and they can't get the people out of the street because there's no place for them to stand. And once they get ringside sales out, the people were hanging off the bars of my ticket booth. I said it was like 15 by 15. There's three of us in there selling tickets. And they were actually climbing up and holding. They were begging. They were saying, please, please, I got to get into this. I want to see this. I'll take anything. Have you got anything? I said, no. We're sold out. Ringside is totally gone. General admission is down both sides. There's lots of ticket booths down both sides. It was mayhem. It was kind of total mayhem because the crowd was so much more than anybody ever anticipated it was going to be. And it was disorganized at that point. It was like, how are we going to get them all in here? So they started selling once the grandstand filled. And I don't know exactly what time it was. I was still outside in the ticket booth that they started selling the standing room. And they had already discussed it, so they went on with ticket sales. And there were entrances beyond the first baseline and the third baseline that you could go out into the field. So those people that were being sold were coming through the crowd, and then they had to work their way down to field level, and then they would come through those gates and go out on the field and stand behind the ringside. When I went into the stadium, probably at 9 o'clock, and the bell was late, because the crowd was so massive, they held the matches. They wanted to get as many people in as they could before they actually started. And there was all this pandemonium in the front. So they held the matches to probably about 9, and they rang the bell around 9 o'clock, 30 minutes late. And I remember going up to the announcer's booth in the stadium itself, and there was nobody up there at that level, and sitting down in a seat and looking out at that view, it was absolutely phenomenal. I'd never seen anything like that. You couldn't see all the people who were in the grandstands because they're directly below you. But to look at the field itself, there were people standing behind ringside almost halfway out to the center field fence. So you had, I don't know how many. It was hard to estimate. I would think that if there were 3,000 people sitting in those ringside and you looked at the numbers standing behind them, rows of probably 30 people, 30 deep, back out into the field, maybe 10,000, another 10,000 standing on the field. It was really phenomenal, phenomenal experience just to see a crowd of that size.
Stud, let me ask you something before you take a timeout. And I'm just thinking about what that night must have been like for your dad and those that were trying to execute that. Obviously, you don't plan to have 180% of your capacity in a 20,000-seat arena. You're talking about a crowd of 38,000 people that show up, as you're talking about, which is an incredible number of people. It's just insane. As a matter of procedure, if they don't anticipate there's going to be that many people, where are they getting the tickets at that point that they're selling people as they continue to come up? How does your dad or any other promoter at that point know that these folks in these ticket offices, because once it becomes total chaos, how do you know that the ticket sellers aren't going into business for themselves and putting some money in their pocket? I mean, at that point, you can't track what's going on. It kind of reminds me of the folks that put on Woodstock, and at some point, people just start crashing the fences, and you can't tell who's a ticket buyer, from who crawled in here. I mean, at some point, it sounds like complete and total mayhem.
Well, they were used to selling to large crowds. The auditorium would hold about 8,000. Sometimes they'd probably put 10,000 in there before the fire marshal would cut them off. So there was some organization to it. The old tickets were sold. The general admission tickets came on a big roll. It was about the size of a 33 disc, you know, the old 33s. And back in the day, somewhere around that size and width. And they were all numbered. Every ticket was numbered. So when you were a ticket seller, if you were selling general admission, you had to account for every ticket sold. So when you left to go sit in that booth. You had your change you were going to deal with. And then you had sometimes three or four rolls that size. Each roll would hold 2,000 tickets, let's say. And you had to account at the end of the night for your tickets. Here's where I started. And here's the row when I ended. And that's how they kept up with, pretty well could keep up with it. But the pandemonium part of it is there's so much going on around you in an event like that where people are just, they're panicked. They're panicked. They've driven down. They've got into this monstrous crowd. They've parked a half a mile away and they've walked. And now they're not going to get in. And they're screaming and begging and they're pleading for a seat. Just please, I want to get in it. Just let me sit or stand up. I don't care. So you've got all that stuff going on around it. And probably some people probably did put some of that money in their pocket because it just got so outrageously big that nobody expected it to get to that level. Ringside, that's a simple operation. You got 3,000 seats. You got 3,000 tickets. Your people on that field, your ushers on that field are responsible for sitting those people in their seats. And they take every one of those 3,000 people as they arrive and walk them down and say, these are your seats. They see their tickets. They know that they're where they're supposed to be. And the usher sees that they have the proper tickets. And that was pretty well controlled. But general admission became out of control. It just became monstrous. There was no way to control what was going on there.
So we set the scene, the chaos of what was going on before the card. We're going to get to the card as we continue. As the Tennessee Stud's laying it down here in episode 23, David Summers has a few messages for you. We'll take a brief time out. Let the Stud catch his breath. And then when we come back, we'll finish. Maybe we'll finish. Super card. 1965, July of 65, 38,000 people in Ponce de Leon Park. Rocky Marciano's on hand. Al Galento's there, Scarpa, Armstrong, Argentina, Rocca. Can you picture it? Close your eyes, those of you that love what we're talking about right now, that love this thing. Close your eyes and imagine what it must have been like on that warm, sweltering July night in that place, Atlanta, Georgia. I want you to picture this now. Think about this. 38,000 people, Atlanta Metro at that point, and surrounding areas. Population in 1965 of 959,000. 38,000 of those people are in that park that night. That's a high concentration of the folks that lived around that area. That's insane. We're going to take a brief time out. Come back with more on your Studcast right after this.
great news for all StudCast fans. After considering the huge demand from fans for much longer StudCast, Ron and Tony have decided to introduce the once-a-month, two-hour deep dive Super StudCast. This fabulous event will release with the inaugural episode on Sunday, January 14th of 2018. These Super StudCast subjects will be exclusively selected by the Tennessee Stud himself. They will not be Google research. They will not be organized and prepared by other people. They will not be the secondhand stories passed down or heard somewhere else. What they will be is the true and unforgettable real-life experiences and memories from one of the great storytellers of all time. Straight from the horse's mouth, the Stud aims to make podcast history with every single Super StudCast. Great thought has been put into deciding who and what the first of these special monthly podcasts will contain. It is my distinct pleasure to announce the subject of Super StudCast number one. It'll be a person near and dear to the Stud, a personal friend in Ron's life for more than 16 years, a person that traveled, talked, ate, partied, and slept in the Stud's home on many occasions, a person that he has never talked about on the StudCast, one of the most recognizable people on earth, and one of the few wrestlers Ron looked up to, both figuratively and literally, one of the greatest stars in the history of the sport. It could only be the big man himself, the one, the only, Andre the Giant. Don't forget to circle Sunday, January 14th of 2018, and every second Sunday each month in 2018 for the release of your Super StudCast. You're listening to StudCast number 23. And now, back with more, it's Tony and the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Tony Basilio welcoming you back on your StudCast. It's 1965, July of 65, a record crowd. As you heard the Stud say right when we left you, 38,000 people are on hand, and they've built this thing up. It is time for the payoff. Stud, take us home.
All right. This is the best part of all of this, obviously. This is what everybody came to see, including me. I'm a junior in high school, and this is a mega event, and I'm in the middle of all of it. I get the opportunity to sell the tickets and to see the outside of the building and the mayhem there. And now I'm going to see the mayhem inside this fabulous crowd. The early matches, I remember, were good matches. They were always good matches. But when you have an event like this, there are certain matches that are key and that the people are waiting. They're just basically waiting to see what's going to happen in the last three, four matches. So you had Bob Armstrong had his match. Scarpa had his match. There were some great, great early matches because they used the guys that were the stars there anyway. So everybody knew all these guys. There was no surprises in these early matches. Big responses. Just part of setting the scene and getting things going. And that's an important part of every night's matches. I always tried to have great talent in my early matches. In Continental days, I had a young Brad Armstrong wrestling a guy named Bill Ash. And those guys started a lot of evenings for me. And it set the pace and the tone for the whole night because they went out there and they busted their butts so much. And other guys would go and watch their matches because their matches were so good. And then they would see what they had to follow. And it forced them to give more when they went to the ring. And the next guy, he watches it and he goes, gosh, man, I've got to really kick butt to really make myself a star here and to keep pace with that the night. So that started from the first match, obviously. And now by the time you get later on in the night, we come to the match. Let's start with the Argentina-Rocco match with Sputnik Monroe. My dad was always, he was a very stiff guy in the ring, and he wasn't just stiff in the ring. He wanted his wrestling to be real. He wanted his fans to see the best wrestling they could see. Dad did not have a good impression of Argentina-Rocco. He did not like that high flyer style in which you climbed up, drop kicked off the top rope, and you did the backflips, and you did all the balancing deals, and he didn't think that was wrestling. Dad's ideal match was to have a total wrestling match and then fight at the end, a little bit of a fight at the end. So he told Monroe, this is crazy, but he told Monroe, he says, I want you during the match tonight with Rocco to hard weigh him, to bust his eye. And Sputnik was like taken aback. You know, Dad and I discussed it years later, and I said, what happened in that match? Because I watched that match, and it ended in a very strange way, and I couldn't figure out exactly why. So Sputnik is a soldier of Dad's who had been many places and helped build these shows and build these mega events. So he does what Dad asked him to do, and he says, are you serious? You want me to Hardway Argentina Rocca? Does he know I'm going to hit him? And Dad says, no, I don't want you to tell him. I just want you, when you get ready to start to get some heat, to bust his eye. So Sputnik goes to the ring with that in mind. Now, that's a strange type of situation now. Rocco, he's from another country. He doesn't speak very good English. He's from South America. He's wrestling in a monster event here against a guy he has never seen or doesn't know anything about. And somewhere during the course of that match, Munro hits him, and I mean really hits him. I mean, you know, he's just pow. I remember watching the match and seeing Rocco go down, and I saw him stay there for a little bit. It was like I couldn't figure out why he was selling that. And he got up. It didn't bust his eye, but he got up, and he rolled out on the apron and stood up, and he went to the dressing room. There was no end to the match. That was the end of the match. They counted him out. They gave him the 10 count. They raised Munro's hand. And that was the flattest match of the night. You know, fans didn't know what happened. I didn't know what happened. The only two people that knew what happened was my dad and Munro. And later on, Dad told me, you know, I wanted him to bust Rocco's eye. I wanted him to hit him the hard way. So that's a strange thing. When you add that at the last minute into a match, because I guess he wanted the legitimacy. He didn't want to see Rocco do all that high flying. But I do remember in the early part of the match, Rocco did a lot of his high flying stuff. But when it came time for Munro to take over, it was basically one punch, bang, and that was the end of it. Rocco went to the dressing room. I think it probably detracted a little bit from what could have happened potentially. But that was my dad's style. He was a little bit of a strange guy. And that was a strange event that happened in there. Pretty ridiculous in a way.
So you disagree with his booking decision, basically, looking back on it.
I do. Yeah, I do. I mean, you at least talk to the guy that you're about to bust his eye, and you say, hey, look, we want to do this real. We want to make this real as we can. But, you know, when you don't talk to him, if I had been in Rocco's shoes, you have then two choices. One, you do what Rocco did. You leave the ring. Or secondly, you go to your shooting skills. If that's what this match is going to be and nobody's told me about it, then I'm going to do my best to hurt you. You want to hurt me, then I'm going to hurt you. It could have very easily gone there, except I don't think Rocco had the skills. He didn't have the skills, and he wasn't a shooter, and he wasn't able to. And Munro was a tough-looking old son of a gun, and if you've never seen Sputnik Munro and you end up in the ring with him, you don't know just how tough he is. So Rocco was put in a very bad situation. That happened during the course of the match. Next match is the World Tag Match with Ray Gunkel and Lester Welch against the Von Brauners from Germany with Saul Weingroff. Absolutely phenomenal match. It rocked the world. It rocked everybody's world there that watched that. The crowd was just electric with the whole match from the beginning to end. The Von Brauners had a great style. They had a really good wrestling ability. They were very big guys and really extremely strong. They did a lot of slams. They liked to slam and bump guys. This is the day before a lot of suplexes. You didn't see a lot of suplexes in the 60s. It was mostly body slams and backdrops, that type of thing. They also, for really big guys, could take tremendous bumps. You could backdrop those guys like they weighed 200 pounds and they were up there 250, 260. They were great workers. And that match was a phenomenal match. And Lester and Ray won the world championship. That set the tone for the evening. It gave the fans whatever lacked in the Rocco match, made up for right there with the world championship trading hands and going to Gunkel and Lester. I don't know how long Gunkel and Lester kept that championship. It probably wasn't very long. I know that they didn't have a rematch against the Von Brauners in Atlanta after that. If someone else won it, I'm not sure. because I didn't go any places other than Atlanta back in those days. I wasn't like one of the boys, that's for sure. I was just a young kid watching all of this. That match, fabulous match. Now we set the stage, and now comes the main event. The introductions. Now, there's no music in those days. I mean, this is not like wrestling were turned into in the 70s and progressed on into the 80s. It wasn't time to play the music, and the guys came. They rang the bell. The crowd stood up. They didn't need music. This is the main event. This is what we came to see. They brought Marciano to the ring first. They introduced former world boxing champion, undefeated, gave him a great intro. He got a huge hand, as you would imagine. They brought Galento and Al, Mario and Al. They both made their entrance into the ring. Galento wore his traditional, he only carried small towel. He didn't have any robes. He didn't dress. He didn't have the Ric Flair robes. He didn't have, that wasn't part of him. He was there to fight, by golly. All I need is this little towel to wipe the blood off of me when I get there, because he's going to bleed every match, and so is his opponent going to bleed every match. So he comes to the ring with his little small towel and Al Galento by his side. They both get into the ring. And then they introduce Dad, and he comes out. It's a big roar. I mean, you know, that's what they came to see. So they don't have the match that they had in Mobile 7 years earlier, in which it's 5 minutes long, and it's just a slaughter match. It's just a brawling fight. They don't go there with this time. They have a wrestling match. They start out having a match itself. They give Marciano the opportunity to become a star, to be the big guy of the evening, as a matter of fact. So they wrestle back and forth, and then finally Galento, Mario, keeps pushing and shoving Marciano. Marciano would try to break him up. If he had Dad in the corner and he's really pummeling him or whatever he's doing, Marciano would physically get in front of him to push him back, and Mario would shove him in the chest. And Marciano would bow up a little bit. Crowd would stand up like, oh, my, he's going to hit him. One of those things. And then they would avoid that spot. And then while all that altercation was going on with them in the middle of the ring, Al would slide around there, and he would be doing stuff to Dad in the corner. While Marciano is face-to-face with Mario, Al is taking advantage of Dad in the corners, getting the heat. And it was, the crowd's going nuts. I mean, it's like they want Marciano. They like him. They want him to think he's doing a good job. But at the same time, they see these being distracted and Dad's being taken advantage of. So the heat becomes really strong. At one point, Al Galento jumps up on the apron and Marciano is arguing with Mario, one of those pushing match back and forth. And Marciano just turns and catches Al Galento standing on the apron with a right hand on the chin, and it knocked him. He went down on the apron. The crowd popped. It was like a roar. Like, you know, he had seen him do a couple little things, and now here's, bang, here's the shot. He hits him with the shot. Down Al goes, and he's out. They come and carry him out. He's gone. He's finished. Now the match is down to Dad and Galento and Mario. And at the end of the match, Dad gets hardwayed. Mario hardways Dad, and Dad busts his eyes too. And they're both bleeding at the end of the match. And they reach a point to where Mario's got Dad in the corner, and Marciano has got him by the arms from behind, and he's basically dragging him off of him in the corner. And Mario turns to face Marciano like another altercation, and Dad full Nelsons him from behind. And Marciano just backs off and lays him out. He hits him with a big right hand. Down Mario goes. Dad covers him. Big, huge pop. You know, match is over. But, you know, I keep talking about these photos and my website and going to that website to be able to look at that gallery to see things. Now, on this episode, I'm going to put the picture of my dad with Rocky Marciano on one side and Paul Jones, the old-time promoter, on the other, holding, and Dad's got the championship belt. It was for the Georgia Heavyweight Championship. Dad's got the belt. And I'd love for fans to go and look at this picture. And when they do, I would like for them to pay particular attention to my dad's eyes. And when I look at that picture, it tells me concussion. I mean, it says how much these guys gave of themselves in a match like this and in a situation like this, that they're willing to hit each other and bust their eyes and bleed real blood, by golly, for those fans. Give those fans as much as they possibly could give them. I mean, in that picture, if you really look closely, you'll see that my dad's not standing, that they've got him by both arms, and they're actually almost holding him up till they can take this shot of him with the belt. But when you look at his eyes, you're going to see that he's not there. They're taking a photo, but he's not there, and he's not smiling. He's got a concussion. He's gone through a horrible event. He's gone through a terrible blow, at least one, maybe two, three. I don't know how many times he hard-weighed him. But, you know, that to me was what the sport was all about in those days. It was what guys gave that they don't give anymore, that they just don't do anymore for the crowd. I think it's, you know, pretty much where I want to kind of leave it is with the difference, kind of the difference between where we are now and where they were in 1965.
And also, when you talk about Rock, I mean, I go back to that. Here's a guy that gets hard-weighed, gets basically punched in his eye, doesn't know it's coming. Does your dad at the end of that share some extra money with him? Does he share extra money with the guys that may have, you know, been on that card simply because it was such a huge gate? How do you think your dad handled that?
Oh, yeah, I know you. Dad paid very well. And he paid well. I think you pay well when you're a wrestler and a promoter, because if you're just a promoter, you never go in that ring and you never go through those experiences and you never blow yourself up and you never take these hard ways. You never do make that commitment. You don't realize what they give in that ring. But when you wrestle and you're a promoter too, and you have these big events and you see these huge crowds and you go out and you watch those matches to see who's giving their all, then you want to pay your guys better than they even have coming. And I'm sure that in the end, he paid Rocco extra. I know he probably didn't go and personally pay him because they were in separate dressing rooms on different sides of the stadium. But whoever did the pay that night probably apologized. You know, they might have said, hey, I'm sorry that, you know, he's kind of a crazy guy and he, you know, tried to make an excuse for Monroe or whatever. And there's a little extra for you in the pay. And I don't know what they pay on an event like that. I don't even know, Tony, what the dollar figure was. I have no idea what the dollar figure was. My guess is that they did not finish counting all the money before midnight, if they finished by then. And I don't know where they went in the facility to count that kind of money. There's no Wells Fargo truck. There should have been. You know, I don't know who walked out of there with the bread. There was a big hunk of bread that night. It was a phenomenal evening. The wrestlers made a lot of money. The crowd got every penny's worth of the money that they spent to get inside. And it's what it all was about back in those days. And I had a few of those times as the story goes on, and I'm going to become the promoter and I'm going to become the main event. I had nights like that in which it was a honest to goodness pleasure just to be a part of it and to think that you're at the top of it and that you really are responsible for it. That takes it to another whole level. It's just a wonderful experience. It was a wonderful experience to be a part of it, to be there and see it. It was the greatest night in the history of Georgia wrestling, and a great night for wrestling worldwide, because it is what 1965 was all about and that 60s era. And me as a young guy, to sit there and see it, I wanted to put on some wrestling tights. I think that might have been the night of my life that I decided what I was going to do with the rest of my life is I want to be a part of this. I want to do this. That's kind of where a good place to leave this, I guess, is we're going to continue on with Georgia And we're not too far away from me getting into the ring, and Rob and Jimmy and the next generation's about to take off.
And if you want to interact with the Tennessee Stud, I want to encourage you to do so on Twitter, Ron Fuller Welch, Twitter and Instagram. Over on Facebook, very vibrant page with many people active, interacting with the Stud, asking questions. Ron Fuller, Tennessee Stud. Again, Ron Fuller, Tennessee is spelled out there. Ron Fuller, Tennessee Stud. The website is tnstud.com. Again, tnstud.com. Stud, anything else you want to add here on the way out? It's been great sitting at the feet of the master storyteller here as we emanate out of Knoxville, Tennessee. Anything else for us, Tennessee Stud?
Just like to wish everybody a Merry Christmas. We're getting close to Christmas time. If you want to go to the Stud Store, we got some things there. If you'd like to give a special gift to somebody, you're certainly welcome to do that. I encourage you to go to the gallery and take a look at these pictures, especially this episode 22 and 23, the picture of Mario from the match in 1958 in Mobile, and the picture on 23 of Dad being unconscious on his feet after this match. You know, and just, again, I know I probably do it all the time. I'm humbled at what's going on here, Tony. Our numbers are just remarkable. For some people, we've become a part of their lives, and they can't wait to Wednesdays to take that new Studcast down. And I appreciate all those people worldwide that are listening to this program and supporting us, be it through Patreon or if you go to the website, make a donation or whatever. And I want to remind people about these Super Studcasts that are going to start in January. And we'll probably next show announce the date. And we will also announce probably the subject that will be for this first Super Studcast. And just, it's a pleasure to be here. I love it. I've ridden my horse these last 2 weeks. And I tell you what, when I take him back to the stable, he's pretty tired. I like having a big long hour match with Harley Race or Jack Briscoe or Ric Flair. I'm pretty worn out after this one, but I love it. And I just want fans out there everywhere around the world to know I appreciate your listening and being a part of it.
Tennessee Stud, you're unsurpassed. And it was absolutely peerless getting an opportunity to sit here with him because it's 93 years, it's four generations, it's coast to coast. The best storyteller in the history of the business, ladies and gentlemen, has just blessed us with a tremendous hour. You can bless him over on the website with his Patreon account and help keep us doing what we're doing here. We pick this thing back up, we'll be right there, smack dab in the middle of the 1960s. What an incredible time in our country, an incredible time in the sport of kings. For the great Ron Fuller, your Tennessee Stud, this is Tony Basilio reminding you that I do a daily show. Update my blog daily at tonybasilio.com. Talk a bunch of sports on my site, show, etc. Love to have you check us out. Check me out. You can find me on Twitter at Tony Basilio, B as in boy, A-S-I-L-I-O. On that note, have yourself a great week. Hey, David Summers, how about if you take us home? Another edition of the Studcast has closed. We love you.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud. This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains. This Studcast is distributed by Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For inquiries about vocal work, send an email to davidsummersproductions@gmail.com.